How important is Balaam? Well, it's interesting. As I was studying, I've been teaching the book of Revelation, and I've, of course, bumped into Balaam in the last reference. And so I started looking at this guy and doing some research. Do you realize that his name appears 63 times in Scripture? He is mentioned in 8 Bible books, 3 of them in the New Testament. Of course, never in a good light. Always God is warning us about Balaam. Now, the point that I'm trying to make is simply this. Apparently, Balaam is a rather important. And when you think about it, think about when Balaam appeared. It was Israel on their way out of Egypt. They had come to the east of the Jordan. They had just destroyed Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan. And they're sitting there. This is back at the time of the Exodus. And here is this guy that God is still talking about in the book of Revelation. So obviously, there's something about Balaam we need to learn. And we're going to talk about it. Apparently, God wants us to learn something. Remember the last reference, Revelation 2:14. I have a few things against thee, because thou hast them there that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel to eat things sacrificed unto idols and to commit fornication. We'll get into that in a little bit. Remember the background. The prophet Balaam got a very attractive offer. Balak, the Midianite king, saw Israel coming, and I love the description he gave of them. He said, they're like an ox that licketh up the grass. In other words, everything before them was, I mean, these two very strong kings on the east side of Jordan, Sihon, king of the Amorites, Og, king of Bashan, and they not only destroyed them, but as far as the record is concerned, there were no casualties. I mean, there is no record of any Israeli casualties during those battles, those wars. So it was amazing. And so Balak got rightly concerned, and he sent to Balaam and asked Balaam to come and to curse him, as you recall. Well, God forbid him to do so, and Balaam tried to make God change his mind. Interesting, he's the man who wrote later on, and by the way, you see those prophecies. Here's what he wrote about God. He is not a man that he should lie, nor the son of man that he should repent. Hath he said, and will he not do it? And hath he spoken, shall he not bring it to pass? In other words, he's the guy who said God doesn't change his mind. But he tried to make God change his mind, didn't he? And God allowed him to go on a journey that was full of disaster. This is, of course, the scene that every Sunday school child will remember about Balaam. He had a donkey that talked to him, right? I've had a few stubborn horses. None of them ever talked to me, at least not verbally. But unless she had turned for me, surely now I would have slain you and kept her alive. There's a whole story behind that, but I don't have time to talk about it. Balaam made some of the most remarkable prophecies about the future of Israel anywhere in the Bible. Remember, this man was a false prophet, and yet God took complete charge, and every time he opened his mouth, he blessed Israel. That tremendous prophecy, I shall see him, but not nigh. I shall behold him, but not now. Behold, a star shall rise out of Israel, and a scepter out of Jacob. And many believe that the Magi read that prophecy, and it was that that connected them to the star and brought them to Jerusalem, saying, where is he that has come, that is born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him. Marvelous prophecies. But he was constantly frustrated when he tried to curse Israel. And so Balak fired him. If you recall, about chapter 24, he gets fired. Chapter 25, he says to Balak, wait a minute, I got one more thing to say. And here's what he did. He counseled Balak, not permitted to curse them. He counseled Balak to corrupt them. And so, basically, we have what we call the doctrine of Balaam. What is the doctrine of Balaam? The doctrine of Balaam is simply this. When you can't curse them, corrupt them. And they will either destroy themselves or God will destroy them. And that's basically the philosophy. So what did Balak do? Well, he sent some of his most beautiful women over to visit Israel, and they enticed the men of Israel to come to the idolatry of the feast of Baal Peor. Baal Peor was noted for its immorality. It was noted for even cannibalism. It was one of the most degraded religious feasts that there was, and Israel fell right into it and brought divine judgment on them. 24. Now, think about it for a minute, folks. Listen, they had fought these two wars with mighty forces and lost apparently nobody. And now 24,000 of them die because of the plague that took place as a result of Baal Peor. Well, let's go to Phinehas. You remember the story. Moses was he brought all the people together, and they were weeping and they were praying. He had the leaders of the tribes together, and there was a giant prayer meeting going on, all of them weeping and so forth. And suddenly one of the tribal leaders comes walking through the prayer meeting with a Moabite woman in tow, who he takes into his tent. You know, sin makes us insensitive, doesn't it? Sin blinds us to the place where we have no sensitivity. And so without ever thought, he walks across. Phinehas, the priest, sees it. The righteous indignation rises within him. He gets up, and when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose from among the congregation, took a javelin in his hand, went after the man of Israel into the tent, thrust both of them through. So the plague was stayed from the children of Israel, and God said, I will give to Phinehas a covenant of peace. Now, why did God say that? Because here was a man who took action against evil. Do you feel it? In other words, he did something about it. He got up and took action, and I think that there's a lesson in that for all of us. Now, what does that have, or what are the lessons of Balaam and the seductions of Baal Peor? Decision Magazine came out with this about a year ago now, but they said the big lies, and down underneath, if you can read that, it says abortion, gender identity, false. Remember about a year ago, I think it was, I brought a seminar here called Bursting the Transgender Bubble. Pastor said it, and he said it very well today. We are not living in reality. We are living in a world of fantasy. Transgenderism is fantasy. It's not reality. It's not related to reality. The same thing with evolution. The more you know about it, in fact, there is so much evidence now against evolution, it's all over the table, that for anybody to believe in it, they're living in the land of fantasy. And so that's where we are. Well, how did it begin? Well, I'd like to start back here with Saint-Simon, I think is the way the French say it, French socialist theorist and chief founder of what he called Christian socialism. Now, that's an oxymoron. But at any rate, that's what he called it, Christian socialism. His major work, he proclaimed a brotherhood of man that must accompany the scientific organization of industry and society. Just remember where this is. Science had just begun to enlighten the world. Science was fairly new. And everybody was jumping on the bandwagon. Hey, science can solve all the problems. Science can tell us everything. And so he was simply applying this idea of science to the social structure. And he said, well, it's got to be accompanied by scientific organization. Now, watch that word. Because when you're organizing something, you're controlling it. Aren't you? And that's exactly... I said that the background of this is Spiritism. Did you know that he was inspired by a vision of his distant relative, Charlemagne, who told him that his family alone was chosen to change the world? And that immediately tells me where this came from. You know, right out of the pit. By the way, I have a sign that I like to give to the grandkids. It says, you want to change the world? Start by making your bed. So early socialism was rife with Spiritism. His chief allegiance was to science and the theory of positivism. He developed the concept of the social sciences. Now, the whole idea was that society can be measured, it can be controlled, it can be duplicated, because that's what science is. It's observation, duplication, prediction, and so on and so forth. And if it isn't that, then it's not science. And so they're saying that the whole idea, folks, we're so accustomed to this phrase. This phrase itself is nonsense. There is no such thing as social. You cannot predict. You cannot control the social society unless you have an organization like socialism becomes. Always subject to mental fits, by the way. Another indication of what?
Demonism,
right? He tried to commit his suicide, ended up just shooting his eye out. Saint Simon advocated, now watch what he advocated for. Early on here, one world society, where we heard that before. Well, way back then, in which businessmen and industrial leaders would control. Now watch this, the spiritual direction of society would be in the hands of scientists and engineers and take the place of the Roman Catholic Church, which of course was in control at that time. So the seeds of socialism were sown very early by this particular man. Well, right about that same time, or just shortly after Saint-Simon, comes Darwin. He lays the foundation of naturalism, the philosophical viewpoint according to which everything arises from natural properties and causes, supernatural or spiritual explanations are excluded or discounted. Every atheistic and godless philosophy since his day rests upon Darwinism for its foundation. How many of you have ever read the book or seen the book, The Long War Against God by Henry Morris? Oh my goodness. That is a book that you really need to get because it's the history of this whole thing. The Long War Against God by Henry Morris. And he traces evolutionary thinking not back to Darwin. He traces it back to the Aryans in India. And takes it right straight up through. So it is a fantastic book, The Long War Against God. Nietzsche, with his philosophy of what he called the death of God, led him to nihilism, which is the rejection of all religious and moral principles, and the belief that life is meaningless and a result of natural forces. Some years ago, Time magazine put out a cover I will never forget. It was on the whole philosophy of nihilism and so forth. And there was a picture of a businessman dressed with a Homburg, as we used to see them, and a business suit and a briefcase, standing on a slab of floating ice in the middle of a sea of nothing. He constructed the formulation of naturalism necessary to affirm atheism and provide justification for the mass killing conducted by Hitler and Stalin. Marx then took the naturalism of Darwin and the atheistic nihilism of Nietzsche and applied them to his philosophy of communism, which he called dialectic materialism. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Once one is convinced that communism is the ultimate good, then atheistic materialism can justify any means of achieving it, including lies, deception, or even mass murder. What's the definition of dialectic materialism? Dialectic materialism basically means conflict in nature. He observed, for instance, that in every atom there are positive and negative forces. Now, he reasoned that because there were positive and negative forces and that these opposed each other, that created energy. Scientists said, no, the energy is there. That's why they oppose each other. But he reasoned that it was this, these opposing forces opposed each other and that therefore, matter was autodynamic. In other words, it would increase itself. You see how this parallels with what Darwin taught. A little bit different approach, but the same thing. So he's basically saying that, matter is autodynamic, it increases itself, thus nature's dialectic, that is its conflict, can account for everything that there is. God is thus irrelevant and unnecessary. Marx truly believed that he had done away with God and explained everything with his conflict theory. It was a small step then to apply the same principle to class warfare. Frederick Engels says, quote, "By discovery of these laws, that is dialectic materialism, the last vestige of a creator external to the world is eliminated." Now, well, let me, because it, Marx said he had two ambitions, two goals for which he lived. To dethrone God and destroy capitalism. He wrote it. He said it. You know, that's the one thing about these guys. All you have to do is go back and read their writings. And it's not that they had kept it a secret. Communism rests its entire case on the, quote, truth of dialectic materialism, which is very easily disproven. So the naturalists were basically at war with God. And the whole system of socialism, communism, and that sort of thing is based upon these naturalistic assumptions and so forth, and it's basically a war against God. Well, let's see how it played out in history. In November 1917, we had the Bolshevik Revolution, overthrowing the Tsar, put a communist government in charge in Russia. You had recognized these two gentlemen, don't you? I mean, you're old enough, most of you, Lenin and Stalin. In 1922, Russia was known as the USSR, the Soviet Union. Vladimir Lenin said this, "Dictatorship is rule based directly upon force and unrestricted by any laws. The revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat is rule won and maintained by the use of violence by the proletariat against the bourgeoisie, rule that is unrestricted by any laws." Now, that's a fantastic statement. But keep it in your mind, because I'm going to give you a statement later on by Woodrow Wilson that absolutely parallels this. Adolf Hitler, following the philosophies of Darwin and Nietzsche, Hitler established his own brand of socialism. It was socialism. It was National Socialism, controlled by the National Socialist Party, whose abbreviation, of course, was Nazi. The common thread in all forms of socialism is the total control of government over every part of life. Understand that. That's what socialism is. It's socialism assumes it knows all. It is smarter than you are. It can control everything. If it controls everything, everything's going to be just great. Well, we know what happens, don't we? Mussolini, about that same time, followed his march in Rome, October 1922. And after removing all political opposition through his secret police and outlawing labor strikes, became the sole ruler of Italy, established a form of national socialism known as fascism. Now, the only difference between these guys and communism is that communism envisions a global thing and says, and in fact, they tell you that the only reason communism maybe hasn't worked too well is because it's not global yet. If it was just global, everything would be fine. So these national socialists had the same form of government, in a sense, but it was confined to the nation. And that brings me to Mr. Antonio Gramsci. This was a new name to me a few months ago. Certainly is not now. Antonio, and I notice I say alias Balaam, because he came with the same theory. Gramsci was a young Italian Marxist that published a radical newspaper called The New Order, which promoted communism. When Benito Mussolini came to power, he set up National Socialism, and Antonio Gramsci wisely fled, fearing Mussolini and desirous to see the workers' paradise for himself. For remember, this is right at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. He fled to Russia. And there he observed the realities of the workers' paradise. And here's what he concluded. It was obvious to Gramsci that the, quote, paradise of the working class maintained its hold over workers and peasants only by sheer terror, mass murder on a gargantuan scale, and by the ubiquitous gnawing fear of midnight knocks on the door and forced labor camps in the Siberian wilderness. I mean, total slavery. He went through, he saw the Bolshevik revolution and the results of it. He witnessed the results of it. He witnessed the mass murders, and we'll look about later on about some of this. He witnessed the parentless children. One of the, if I forget everything else that I see on this particular DVD video, there's one scene I cannot forget. It was an actual footage filmed in Russia after they eliminated marriage and the state took control of all children. And it's a picture of babies on a conveyor belt as they're moved along to the various state nurses who will take care of them. That's communism, socialism, the prisoners of the gulag. And Gramsci saw it all. I was studying the book of Revelation, as I said, and I happened to be referenced Dr. Harry Ironside. How many of you know Dr. Ironside? You know of him? Well, this is found on page 115. If your commentary was printed by Lawasa Brothers, here it is. He says, we see a foreshadowing of the tribulation in what is so lately. Now, remember that he wrote this in 1920. What has lately taken place in Russia? The blooding out of the Romanov dynasty, the wrecking of all industrial and social order, the fearful orgies of fanatical Bolshevism, blood and red anarchy holding sway, promises of liberty, keep that in your mind, while destroying every safeguard against unrestrained brutality. Take the attempted abolition of marriage and the forcing of all women to be common property, taken by whomever may desire them, and all children born in these abominable conditions, taken from their parents to be raised by the state. Natural affection at once receives its death blow, and all restraint on man's animal propensities is at an end. Quite a statement, huh?
Sounds like Romans 1, giving them over.
Yes. So when Lenin died, Stalin came to power. And Gramsci got really smart. He fled again. This time, he decided to prefer Mussolini than to Stalin. Stalin killed 60 million people, not 6 million. That was Hitler. He killed 60 million people. Someone as well said, communism is the most efficient killing machine that has ever been invented. And this is just Stalin. I mean, about 154 million, I think, is the total global number that they come up with when they're talking about what communism has done. Well, after all he witnessed, Gramsci was still an avowed communist. But he believed that for communism to succeed, it had to first win the hearts and minds of the people. As he observed, he said, more meaningful to ordinary people than class solidarity and class warfare were such things as faith in God, love of family and country. These were foremost among their overriding allegiances. Do you notice the three things? Faith in God, love of family, love of country. Okay? So therefore, Gramsci reasoned that these loyalties must be removed from the hearts of the people. To achieve that, there must be a change in the culture. Gramsci saw three major obstacles that had to be overcome in order to gain cultural change, the changes that he sought. Religion, patriotism, and the family. The patriarchal family. These were the three things that stood in the way of socialism. Was the first thing that Lenin did eliminate marriage? And eliminate the patriarchy. Lenin said, women are much easier to control that don't have husbands. But he was giving them liberty. By the way, did you know that it was a women's liberation movement? That's what it was called back then when Lenin did it. But Gramsci believed that in the place of the frontal attack of a revolution, it would be more advantageous and less hazardous to attack the enemy's society subtly. with the aim of transforming the society's collective mind gradually over a period of a few generations from its former Christian worldview to one more harmonious to Marxism. So to change the culture, Gramsci taught that socialism must achieve what he called cultural hegemony. Do you understand what that is? Total control over everything that stabilized and preserved the present social order. Gramsci argued that alliances with a broad spectrum of leftist groups. Up until that time, communism was forever fighting itself. Every little communist party was fighting some other communist party and so forth. Gramsci said, no, we can't win that way. What we've got to do is any party that is trying to take over any part of the government will support it. We'll try to do it. Gramsci argued that alliances over a broad spectrum would bring a communist victory. Mastery over the loyalties and consciousness of the great mass of people can be attained only if communists or their sympathizers gain control of the organs of culture. Here they are, churches, education, newspapers, magazines, all forms of media, serious literature, music. This guy was writing this back then. By the way, I failed to tell you, when he went back to Italy, Mussolini arrested him, put him in prison, and he wrote what is called the prison notebooks, 20 books, about over 2,000 pages of how to do it. And basically, it was the advice of Balaam: corrupt the culture, it'll destroy itself, and it'll come to a place where it has to have somebody step in, and then we'll step in.
Antichrist.
Yeah. Total control hegemony. One need not even control, like this statement, watch it now. One need not even control all the information itself if one can gain control over the minds of those that assimilate the information. He must have been watching CNN. At any rate, under such conditions, serious opposition disappears since men are no longer capable of grasping the arguments of Marxism's opponents. Men will indeed love their servitude and not even realize that it is servitude. And here's the obstacles. Gramsci saw culture as the means for transforming the three major obstacles to socializing society. They needed to corrupt the church. He wrote this. They need to corrupt the church, discredit patriotism, and disintegrate the family. Does this sound like something that might just be relevant? Ladies and gentlemen, socialism was conceived in spiritism, inaugurated in violence, and then disguised as benevolent. Write that down. Get that in your mind. Socialism was conceived in spiritism, inaugurated in violence, and then disguised as benevolent, and I call that evil. Well, his theories, the theories of Gramsci, were taken over by the Fabian Society in England. Now, if I had time, I'd talk about the Frankfurt School over in Germany, but I don't have time. But I want to center here on Fabianism. Fabian Society, organized in 1884, built upon Gramsci's theory of cultural hegemony and developed a graduated approach to changing the culture and hence the individual. George Bernard Shaw was one of the founders and one of the most famous, probably, of the Fabians. Influenced by his reading, he became a member of the Fabian Society, advocating for a gradual spread of socialism by peaceful means. He married fellow Fabian and Irish heiress Charlotte Payne Townshend in 1898, but the marriage was never consummated at Charlotte's insistence. Why? Well, here's where I divert for a minute. This may give us a clue of what socialists think of marriage. They despise the idea of one individual love because they say it diverts from people being able to give full submission to the all-powerful state. You can't have two loves. And so both socialists and Islam, by the way, hate Valentine's Day. Do you know that last Valentine's Day, up along the line of control in above north of India. Where am I? In No, it's that area, the beautiful area up there. I was in India and I know where it is, but I can't even think. Why? Kashmir, up in Kashmir, which, as you know, is still controlled by India, but Pakistan and these pockets. A whole group of burqa-clad Muslim women went into a bookstore and tore up all of the Valentine cards that were there and left because they were so, it was disgusting. Well, listen, it's interesting that feminist and communist Jane Fonda wants to transform Valentine's Day into Violence Against Women Day. Socialism, now listen to the theory, socialism reduced to a simplest legal and practical expression means the complete discarding of the institution of private property and transforming it into public property. And then the redistribution of the resultant public income equality and indiscriminately, equally and indiscriminately among the entire population. And Bernard Shaw says, I want to destroy ownership in order that possession and enjoyment may be raised to the very highest point in every section of the community. Now, I think it's important for us to know a little about these people that are writing this. What do they think? You know, what is it? So I copied some things out of George Bernard's sayings. Here's what he says. Capitalism has destroyed our belief in any effective power other than self-interest backed by force. Now, there have been some pretty dark pages in the history of capitalism, and I can see where he may have looked at that, especially with the Industrial Revolution's changes and some of the things that took place early on. But that's where he's coming from. Look at this one. The Nazi movement is one which in many respects has my warmest sympathy. You get where he's coming from. Here's one. I'm an atheist and I thank God for it. And finally, a perpetual holiday is a good working definition of hell. I wonder if he still thinks that. How many of you know what we're looking at? Well, this is called the Fabian Window. It's a very famous work of art that was done for the Fabian Society in England. Up at the top, it says, remold it nearer to the heart's desire. You see two people beating on a red-hot earth on an anvil. Do you see them there? The guy on the right in the green, that's Bernard Shaw. The guy in the red is Sidney Webb, who was the second founder of the Fabian Society. And then this guy back here who's working the bellows is a guy in the name of Pease. He was a treasurer and secretary to the Fabian Society. Now, down below here, you see the ladies on the one side. And by the way, I'm told that each one of these represented an actual Fabian person. But they're kneeling and worshiping these writings. The same thing on the other side, except that there's one guy way back here who is thumbing his nose at the whole bunch. Now, let me explain it to you. G.B. Shaw and Sidney Webb hammer the earth to reshape it, while Edward Pease operates the bellows. And H.G. Wells thumbs his nose at those who bow in reverent worship of Fabian writings. H.G. Wells used to be a Fabian. And he left the Fabian school and then mocked them and so forth. But now, notice where the motto is taken from. You get your wisdom from Omar Khayyam. Ah, love, could thou and I with fate conspire to grasp this sorry scheme of things entire? Would not we shatter it to bits and then remold it nearer to heart's desire? Shatter it to bits, remold it nearer to heart's desire. So that's the whole, that's the Fabian philosophy. That's where they're going. Now, they have a shield. And here it is. It's found on the window. This is just another picture of it. What do you see on the shield?
Dogs.
Wolf. A wolf in sheep's clothing. I mean, they're not even keeping it a secret, people. mean, they're telling you we're going to deceive you. The tortoise, everybody knows the story of the tortoise and the hare. Who won the race? The tortoise. Why? Slowly plodding. But notice what it says underneath. When I strike hard. Did you know that Tony Blair is a Fabian? And in fact, he just rededicated the Fabian window. It had been out of circulation for a while. And he says, quote, the Labor Party owes a great debt to the Fabians. Well, you know the direction that the Labor Party is now going in England. John Flynn says this, the line between fascism and Fabian socialism is very thin. Fabian socialism is the dream. Fascism is Fabian socialism plus the inevitable dictator. So it was the same old doctrine of Balaam dressed in a different suit. Corrupting them was the path to conquering them. So how does that work in America? Well, let's see. John Adams, our second president, and in my opinion, one of the best, wrote these words. He said, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Freedom and free enterprise, he said, are the fruits of morality. How do you like that? I mean, fabulous statement. Our founding fathers understood man's nature. They understood that man is fallen. And the history of human government. That is why they gave us a government of three branches, legislative, executive, and judicial, providing us with checks and balances. Noah Webster, the Christian religion is the most important and one of the first things in which all children under a free government ought to be instructed. But in 1928, Fabian John Dewey toured Russia with a group of educators, and later that year, the New Republic published Dewey's Impressions. This is the title of his book, Impressions of Russia and the Revolutionary World. This polemic stands as a remarkable testament to the progressivism's disdain for mankind, reason, and truth. It is also Dewey's most honest and concise primer on the principles of the progressive education method. And here's what the editor wrote. Anyone prepared to defend the idea of government-controlled schooling after reading this work is perhaps beyond reach of rational argument.
is Dewey the one that Truman beat?
No. That was Governor Dewey. This is John Dewey. We call him the head of public education. He's the one that founded public education in the United States as we know it.
Yes, he did.
He founded the teachers' unions. John Dewey's theory of progressive education. The theory of education is that concerning learning by doing, that sounds, you know, reasonable, purports that children learn best when pursuing their own interests and satisfying their own needs. So you let every kid do what he wants to do. That's the point. The foundations of America.
Just do term papers when they hate them.
Yeah. The whole thing is anti-individualism and educating them for the collective. Educating them for the collective. That was his theory. Listen to what he says. John Dewey said, there is no God, there is no soul. Hence, there is no need for the props of traditional religion. This is the man behind public education in America today. He's the one that founded it. Now that brings me to our first socialist president, Woodrow Wilson, a Presbyterian. Listen to what he says. Now, notes that I gave you there. There's two pages of this from right out of his writing. So I'm only quoting just a little bit, but listen to this. Limitation of public authority by individual rights must be forsaken. No line can be drawn between private and public affairs which the state may not cross at will. Here's how he sums it all up. Omnipotence of legislation, in other words, all power, omnipotence of legislation is the first postulate of all just political theory. Well, so much for limited government. Huh? The feminist movement. War on the patriarchal family. And that's what it is. Understand that. The patriarchal, by the way, if you want something interesting, Google patriarchal family. I did. I thought I must have spelled it wrong. Because the whole page came up, matriarchal family, matriarchal, matriarchal, matriarchal. What is this? Finally, at the bottom, there was a little definition of patriarchal family. Oh, that's one where daddy is in control. American feminist and eugenics activist Margaret Sanger founded the American Birth Control League, or Planned Parenthood. In 1914, Sanger launched The Woman Rebel. That was a magazine. A monthly newsletter promoting contraceptives using the slogan, no gods, no masters. Do you see where this is coming from, folks? This is a spiritual war. This is not politics. She was an active worker for the Socialist Party. Her friends included anarchists and radicals of all stripes. Leader of the feminist movement, Betty Friedan, was a committed communist and a great admirer of Stalin. Like all communists, she saw the patriarchal family as an obstacle and a threat to social change she desired. In your notes there, you'll have a statement by her. She says, the patriarchal family is a comfortable concentration camp. She considered, She considered traditional marriage a form of slavery and scorned women who were devoted to it. In 1954, she wrote a book, The Feminine Mystique, attacking the domestic role of women in the home. In 1976, now listen to this, a New York literary club included her book, along with the works of Marx and Mao Zedong, in its exhibit about books that stirred millions of people and changed their lives. They called the display Books as Troublemakers. Feminism of the wealthy. The feminist movement promoted and was greatly helped by the government welfare program. These in turn contributed to the destruction of the family because it made the father as a provider unnecessary. Under President Franklin D. Roosevelt, the Social Security Act was enacted in 1935, amended in 1939, to establish programs to provide aid in segments of the population. This is a cartoon that was done at that time. I just happened to find it. Look at it. The cartoonist saw that socialism was taking place. We've become so accustomed to it, we don't even recognize it. We've grown accustomed to it, but it was recognized as socialism when first introduced. Welfare's endgame. One of Gramsci's goals was to overload the welfare system so that the number of receiving aid would be greater than the number of producers, those working to support the program. And eventually the system would collapse. That's their goal. Do you get that? That is not an accident along the way. That's the goal. Now, why? Because when that occurs, anarchy will break out and all-out communism would be instituted. Socialists create a crisis and then offer themselves as the answer to the crisis. Social activism, riots, chaos, and anarchy. Mr. Saul David Alinsky, author, activist, liberal community organizer. Well, we're in Chicago, aren't we? Or nearly. Rabble rouser. Alinsky's approach to community organizing stressed self-interest as the generating reality of life. He taught that the end justifies whatever means may be necessary. If you've read his book, I mean, how many of you have read Rules for Radicals? You really should. You really should. On the first page, it says this, lest we forget at least an over-the-shoulder acknowledgement to the very first radical from all our legends and so on and so forth. The first radical known to man who rebelled against the establishment did it so effectively that he at least won his own kingdom, Lucifer. What did I say? This is a spiritual war. folks. This is not politics. We're at war with deep spiritual powers. Now, somebody said, "Oh, he dedicated his book to Lucifer." No, he didn't dedicate his book to Lucifer. Technically, he just made Lucifer the role model for his cause. Beware of useful idiots. What are they? Well, they're the people that are really not communists and not socialists. They just kneel during the pledge to the flag and the national anthem and so on. All right, well, let me move on. In other words, they promote without really intending. True revolutionaries, Alinsky said, do not flaunt their radicalism. They cut their hair, put on suits, and infiltrate the system from within. And here's some of his students. There was a book, a paper written by a student, Truth About Rules for Radicals. Anybody recognize the student? You got it. Here's his students. There's the book, Rules for Radicals, and she's just a little older there. And she wrote her master's thesis on it, which was locked up and nobody can get it. George Soros, the deep pockets of the deep state and the entire radical left. $18 billion, that's billion with a B, donated $18 billion war chest to Open Society Foundation for Socialist Movements. And so he's supporting anti-fascist action, including armed insurrection and so forth. In the Berkeley riots, there were quite a number of arrests made. Did you know that only three who were arrested were from Berkeley? All the rest of them were agitators that were sent in. Now, people pay agitators to do this. They don't do it free. This isn't out of the goodness of their heart that they come in to do this. So who paid them? Or who paid these? And here's Antifa propaganda. Notice what it says. No Nazis in Berkeley. Now, these people have not obviously read history, because the brown shirts that brought Nazism to power in Germany used the exact same tactics that these people used. They shouted down anybody they did not want to hear, or they created riots on the street and in the universities. They did exactly what these people are doing here in Germany. They were the Nazis, but they turned it upside down. And you're the Nazis. Pardon me, I hate to be, but do you notice that girls really get into this more than boys do? I mean, you notice this? I mean, the guys are shouting, but look at these girls. Racism is a disease. Revolution is the cure. They believe it, folks. That's right. That's what our colleges are doing. People, peace, and planet before profits. We are the Communist Party USA because a better world is necessary, and the kids believe it. Students march. Remember, what was there, a million of them, I think? They said there was, at least. Now, does anyone seriously believe this was a grassroots movement? I mean, that's what we were told. The press all said it was grassroots. Does anyone believe that a million high school students self-organized, funded their travel, paid for their food, provided special march permits, media screens, podiums, and flew in speakers and entertainers? I mean, do you really believe that? I mean, do people ever think anymore when they see the news? I don't think so. Or maybe not. The experts all agree gun control works. Well, that's rewriting American history. Harold O.J. Brown said this: we see in contemporary American life, now notice we've talked about the family, haven't talked too much about the church yet, we've talked about the family and how they've attacked that. He says, now we're talking about history and patriotism, in which the great historic symbols of our nation's past, including great presidents, soldiers, explorers, thinkers, are portrayed as having been unforgivably flawed with racism, sexism, and therefore basically evil. And here's what he says. He says their place has now been taken by pro-Marxist charlatans, pseudo-intellectuals, rock stars, leftist movie celebrities, and the like. Oh boy, I've got to hurry. So let me get going. By the way, if you think this happened, Arcata, California just removed the statue of President McKinley a couple of weeks ago because it was offensive to certain Native Americans. All over the South, they're taking down the statues of Robert E. Lee and the Confederate statues. In other words, they're destroying our heritage, our history, because they're going to try to destroy our patriotism. Always remember, listen, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. So no matter what the issue is, they get on the bandwagon, but it's really not the issue. The issue is to create chaos and eventually bring about the revolution, the breakdown of the family and society. Why do all TV dads, why are all TV dads bumbling idiots? Born out of the sitcom dysfunctional family, he is a deliberate subversion of the standard role of the father of the 50s. Now the bumbling father is so ubiquitous, the traditional dad is nearly forgotten. The new dad is usually lazy, gluttonous, inept, clumsy, pathetic, and more to be pitied than respected, obeyed, or admired. No wonder a recent... Remember the goal? Destroy the family. No wonder a recent book came out, The Last Patriarch. Good title. What Americans now approve? Divorce 73%, sex between unmarried 69%. You can read it. Polygamy 17%. I remember a nation when every day in public school we began with prayer. How many of you can remember that? We're actually there. Yeah. Yeah, that's what we did. We began with prayer. We began with a reading from the scriptures, and we pledged allegiance to the flag. There's a new pledge out today. I don't have it here. I just don't have enough room. Films and television had no profanity. I came from the state of Pennsylvania. And in Pennsylvania, they were not allowed to show Gone with the Wind because there was one swear word in it. And they had to take it out before they could show it. Political leaders disagreed. They did and so forth. Well, a child could ride his bike almost anywhere with safety. Now listen to this. Here's why I said that. Critical to the Gramsci success is the disappearance of all memory of the old civilization and way of life. The older America of unregulated lives, honest government, clean cities, crime-free streets, morally supportive and edifying entertainment, family-oriented way of life is no longer vivid in the minds of many Americans. Once it's gone completely, nothing will stand in the way of the new Marxist civilization. And we can't start too soon. Sex ed, from the very beginning, the goal is to sexualize and socialize students and keep them from thinking independently. Franklin Graham said it well. He said, now they study pornography 101. We've come all the way from Norman Rockwell's America. Remember those beautiful pictures of freedom of religion, freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom of speech, to Hugh Hefner's America, freedom to fornicate. And a few years we had, when Obama was in, we had to endure this. And of course we've seen all of this, and I just mentioned where we are right now. And we are very, very sick. That's why I'm saying, but it's not too late if we get on our knees. But my God, we've got to come to. The church still thinks it's business as usual. Infiltrating the church. 300 of the clergy of this country are declared to be allied with the socialist movement by open profession. Many more secretly in sympathy. Active propaganda is contemplated by the ministers who have recently formed in New York what is known as the Ministers' Socialist Conference. This is from the United Methodist. He said, our church, through the auspices of the Women's Division, provides strong support to all the socialist causes. The church has moved from social gospel to social justice. By the way, that's the buzzword, you know. And now it's supporting many socialist organizations whose goal is to establish a Marxist utopia. Because the new left lacked cohesion, it fell apart as a political movement. However, its revolutionaries reorganized into a multitude of single-issue groups, radical feminists, black extremists, anti-war peace activists, animal rights groups, radical environmentalists, and gay rights groups, all embraced and promoted by the church. All of these groups pursue their piece of the radical agenda through a complex network of subversive organizations. stations. I've listed them here. I don't have time to go over them. Here's one. Texas, what does it say there? Texas Christian University. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Where students can get credit for doing an internship with Planned Parenthood. Oh. Helping with abortions. So you were talking about the colleges and so on and so forth. Boy, that was great this morning. I mean, he was absolutely right. So communists' goal to destroy the United States. In January 1963, Communist Albert Herlog read a list of 45 communist goals into the congressional record. Now, this book, The Naked Communist, was written by an ex-FBI agent and political theorist. I have the book. I have read the book, every page. It's called The Naked Communist, lays out the whole progressive plan. By the way, it was reprinted in 2014 and sold over a million copies. So it is available. You ought to get it. So here's some of their goals. Achieve cultural hegemony. What did I say? Goes right back to my friend Antonio Gramsci. They listen well. Infiltrate the press, get control of editorial writing, policy-making positions, gain control, and so on and so forth. All of this is Gramscian agenda. The long march through the institutions. You remember the tortoise? It's slow, but when I strike hard. To debauch the culture, weaken the will of the individual to resist. It's Balianism at work. International globalism developed the illusion that total disarmament by the U.S. would be a demonstration of moral strength. Thank God our present president does not believe that. Promote the U.N. as the only hope for mankind. Use technical decisions of the courts to weaken basic American institutions. And unless we get some new judges, we're in trouble. Discourage the teaching of American history on the ground that it's only a minor part of the big history, the big picture. If you want in my opinion, some of the best books that I've read on American history, get the Heaven Rescued Land, the two books written by Phil Stringer up there on American history. Absolutely fantastic. Belittle all forms of American culture, discredit the American founding fathers, present them as selfish aristocrats and slave owners. Have you been reading the newspaper lately? Degrade morality, present homosexuality, degeneracy, normal, healthy, and health. Eliminate all laws governing obscenity. Call them censorship. Break down cultural standards of morality. Promote pornography and obscenity. Pervert education. Get control of the schools. Check that one off. Use them as a transmission belt for progressive socialism. Soften the curriculum, corrupt the textbooks, get the teachers control the teachers' associations. This first teachers' association meeting that Betsy DeVos went to, they shouted her out. She wasn't even allowed to speak. And she's the head of the Secretary of Education in America. Use student riots to foment public protests. Discredit religion, infiltrate churches and seminaries, replace revealed religion with social religion, discredit the Bible, emphasize the need for intellectual maturity, eliminate prayer, any religious expression in the schools. I wish I had time to talk on some of these. Control political parties, check that one off. Support any socialist movement that can gain centralized control over any part of the culture. Education, social agency, welfare program, anything that can get control, support it. Destroy patriotism. Discredit the American Constitution, calling it inadequate, out of step with modern needs. Do away with, well, we've got Supreme Court justices that believe that. Do away with all loyalty oaths, including the pledge to the flag. Discredit American culture by degrading all forms of artistic expression. Like this, they said, eliminate meaningful sculpture from parks and buildings. Substitute shapeless, awkward, and meaningless forms. Our plan is to promote ugliness, repulsive, meaningless art. Well, they've done pretty well. Dismantle the family, discredit the family as an institution, encourage promiscuity, emphasize the need to raise children away from the negative influence of parents, attribute prejudice, mental blocks, retarding of children to suppressive influence of parents, especially religious parents. And so here we go. It's just the same old doctrine of Balaam or Gramsci. Take your pick. It's the when you can't curse them, corrupt them. We've already spent too much time at BOPR. Now, let me try to finish up real quickly, just in a couple seconds. Progressive socialists, I see three barriers to their see three barriers. The church, which is the bulwark of our spiritual conviction and strength. patriotism, which makes us proud of our country and loyal to our historic heritage, and the patriarchal family, which binds us together with strong cords of human love, and the world, and forms the worldview we embrace and molds us into responsible adults. Now, my time is up, and I dare not go over, so let me finish up. How many of you remember Billy Sunday? Is that right? Well, my mother got saved under Billy Sunday's ministry. He came to Pennsylvania and was preaching in the cricket field, and a 13-year-old girl went and received Christ. Billy Sunday hated the liquor industry, just like I hate progressive socialism. And here's what he said about it. He said, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility to the liquor industry. As long as I have a fist, I'll hit it. And as long as I have a foot, I'll kick it. And as long as I have a head, I'll butt it. And as long as I have teeth, I'll bite it. And when I'm old and helpless and toothless, I'll gum it till I go to heaven and it goes to hell."
Amen.
And I just want to say in closing, I have sworn on the altar of God eternal hostility to progressive socialism. As long as I have a fist, I'll hit it. As long as I have a foot, I'll kick it. As long as I have a head, I'll butt it. As long as I have teeth, I'll bite it. And when I'm toothless, I'll gum it till I go to heaven and it goes to hell.
Amen.